The 29th of May, 1630, is a significant date in British history. The future King Charles II was born. Later propaganda would claim that his birth was marked by a noonday star, a bright object clearly visible during full daylight. Now, Martin Lunn, MBE, and historian Dr. Lila Rakosi think that they've identified the source, a supernova thought not to have occurred until over 40 years later.
As a historian, I'm claiming that something genuinely astronomical was seen in 1630. I leave it to Martin the astronomer. Well, I'll let you speak for yourself.
Well, I'm claiming that the object that these people in 1630 saw was in fact the light coming in from the supernova that astronomers today refer to as Cassiopeiae.
So let's take this back a step. So 1630, why should that be of interest to us today?
The supernova is known to have exploded and the light reached the Earth in the 17th century. Current wisdom says 1670-ish. If our investigations are correct and we place the light reaching the Earth at 1630, then the astrophysicists who study Cassiopeiae, they're going to have to do some recalculations, because what it means is the light is reaching the Earth 40 or 50 years ahead of current wisdom, and that must have massive implications for some of their investigations.
Surely the evidence that they've used so far to put the current date on it must be pretty solid.
Supernova Cassiopeiae is about 11,000 light years away. The light echoes that were picked up in 2005 reflect off a gas cloud which is about 160 light years from the supernova remnant. It's the word about which is really quite important, because in this world of, this scientific world of micro-analysing everything, to suddenly say it's about 11,000 light-years away and the gas cloud is about 160 light-years from the explosion implies that they don't exactly know how far away it is. So if we turn around and say that we believe the light reached the Earth in 1630 rather than 1670, there has to be room for doubt.
So what first drew your attention to this particular event and to this particular date? Surely you weren't just going through checking all of the dates of all of the supernovas we have recorded?
Absolutely not. I had what would be referred to as a eureka moment. I was looking at a book on comets and folklore, and I came across this picture which depicted the sun in the sky and a bright star beside it. I looked at the date, and the date of the drawing referred to 1630, although the image itself was produced in 1660. And in my very simplistic way, I simply put two and two together. Bright star, 17th century, supernova, must be Cassiopeiae. I then had the good fortune to be talking to my very good friend, Dr. Rakosi, a post-medievalist expert, and she very quickly sort of pulled me down to size and said, "You cannot base an argument on a picture."
This must have been quite an unusual topic for you to be discussing it, if your main work is more historical.
It was actually quite exciting. I have a layman's interest in astronomy. It's been really exciting being able to kind of learn more about the astronomical side of things, and Martin's been able to kind of pull me down as well in times when I've gone, "Oh, well, maybe it's..." No, astronomically, that won't work. So it's been a good partnership.
We probably shouldn't trust a picture drawn up 40 years after an alleged event. So where do we go from there? How do we start to actually try and confirm it?
Well, for me, it started with a long, hard look through the archives in Britain. I really wanted a 1630 source, and eventually we found it. It's Britanni Nautilus, and I apologize for those who know Latin, because I don't, so I probably just butchered it. But it's a book of 137 poems written by Oxford academics. So we're talking about the cream of the British intelligentsia of the time. Lawyers, physicians, Hebrew, Arabic specialists, and even astronomers. John Bainbridge, he's one of our authors. He was the first civilian professor of astronomy at Oxford University. So I'm hoping that any skepticism on the part of the astrophysics community about this being a book of poems will be offset by the fact that for some of the poems, they're poems written by astronomers.
And I guess where we don't have astronomical data, we have to rely on whatever other contemporary reports we do have.
That brings up a good point, which is the 17th century is a period where science is in transition. So you've got a period where yes, you do have what we would consider modern astronomical observations being made, but they're peppered with a lot of pseudosciences. I mean, alchemy is still a big player in the 17th century, clear up to Newton's period. So I do think you have to take the wheat with the chaff. You know, you've got to look for the data where you can find it.
Poetry is well and good as a literary resource or as a historical resource, but do they make any other comments about astronomical events that we know that we can actually trust?
They do, actually. They make at least two. We have two references in particular. The first one that they reference is an eclipse that occurred, I think it was the following day or the following or 2 days following the birth of Charles II. And we know from astronomical sources, of course, that this eclipse did in fact happen. Another reference that they make, they refer to it as King James's star. And this is basically a comet that was identified in, I believe it was 1618. And the poem's reference, is this a visit by King James's star again? So they didn't quite realize the astronomical significance, but we have at least two references where they're talking about genuine events. So my argument as a historian is, if they're referencing these two real astronomical events, why not the noonday star being a real one?
How do you expect the astronomical community are going to respond to this? Do you think that they will think that this isn't hard enough data and so we probably shouldn't shift that date?
I suspect there will be some prejudice involved. I suspect that because I'm working with Lila, historian, and we're using lots of historical facts, I'm suspecting there will be some scepticism. I think science has to be open. It has to be receptive to ideas, maybe from areas that are outside its normal comfort zone. But just because they are outside that comfort zone doesn't mean to say they can be just dismissed.
So what is the next stage for you? What do you hope to do to try and find out a bit more?
What I would like to see is not just research, continuing research in Britain in the archives, but I would like to see archives around the world, researchers there having a second look at collections that date to the 1630s, specifically looking for any kind of references to a star that appeared during the day. And it might be a reference in a letter, a diary, a broadsheet. I have a feeling that they're there, we just haven't been looking in the right spots.
And also I think it highlights the importance, the value of different disciplines working together. This cross-disciplinary approach is often used very glibly today. Here we've got a real example. We've approached a problem from different angles and we've come up with an answer which probably wouldn't have been achieved if it was just purely a historian or an astronomer doing that research. And hopefully, in the future, more people from different disciplines might be prepared to work together to try and solve some of the many riddles that still exist today.
Martin Lunn, former curator of astronomy at the Yorkshire Museum, and historian Lila Ricosi explaining their controversial idea presented at the National Astronomy Meeting this year.